This is Audible.
River Publishing presents The Killing of Uncle Sam by Rodney Howard Brown and Paul L. Williams. Read by Ian Patterson. For the River School of Government, our hope for the future. Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said to me, Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down, to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. Jeremiah, chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. A message to the reader. Many years ago, I began asking questions about how things work in the world, governments, banking, etc. The answers to my questions were not what I wanted to hear. I realized that people in leadership and those who guide them from behind the scenes were not altruistic as we would hope they would be, but rather they were greedy, ambitious, and destructive. This book, The Killing of Uncle Sam, was born out of a desire to explore the journey of how we arrived at this place in history. How do we change it? Where do we go from here? To understand history, you must understand people's motivation, not just their actions. After years of traveling the world, trying to help people, I had a hard time grasping how hard-hearted people in positions of power could be. I didn't understand how people could sell out their nations and people just for money. Truly, the love of money is the root of all evil. Pride, greed, and power drive men to do the unthinkable. We have politicians who promise one thing and do another. It seems that many have sold their soul to the highest bidder. How does a legalized system of the private central banks go unchecked? The Ponzi scheme of Bernie Madoff was called the crime of the century, but it was not. The crime of all crimes is the legalized central banking system of the globe, where, with the help of politicians, the banks fabricate money out of nothing and pillage billions of people. The only consolation is that there is coming a day when everyone will give an account of their lives as they stand before Almighty God on Judgment Day, with no lawyer, no lies, no facade, just them and the true record of their life. I come from South Africa, and I always knew something was wrong. I just could not put my finger on it. I found out that the modus operandi of the cabal is to pit people against each other and then, while they are fighting, dispossess them of their wealth. There are wars and genocide as men fight over the mineral wealth of nations, oil, gold, diamonds, and the list goes on. You will find this book well documented with over 1,000 footnotes. I believe this book will tell the tale of the past 200 years with the common thread throughout being greed and covetousness, the love of money. In this book, you will find quotes from former presidents, prime ministers, mayors, and other leaders trying to warn the people, even though, for the most part, the warnings were overlooked by the masses. You can't see something if you don't know what you are looking for. From Cecil John Rhodes to the present day, nothing much has changed. Many who endeavor to expose the problem and to do something about it are silenced. However, it is time for people to stand up and say enough is enough and draw a line in the sand. As far as we are concerned, we will not tolerate these things while it is our watch. We will stand, expose, speak out, and move to bring about a reformation. We feel so strongly about this that if it means death, then so be it. Our founding fathers, the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, were prepared to lose everything for their nation and their freedom, and many did. Out of respect for them, in our generation, we will stand up. It's time. Dr. Rodney M. Howard Brown, Tampa, Florida, USA. Prologue. Killing Uncle Sam. To destroy a people, you must first sever their roots. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. The title seems absurd. How is it possible to kill a nation? America is not a flesh-and-blood entity, but rather an ideology, a shared belief in the principles set forth in such documents as the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. This concept of America dates back to 1910, when British author G.K. Chesterton wrote, "America is the only nation in the world that is founded on a creed, one set forth with theological lucidity in the Declaration of Independence." This concept, known as creedalism, has been advanced by sociologists, historians, and political theorists, such as Gunnar Myrdal, Alan Bloom, and Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. Bill Bennett said, "The American national identity is based on a creed, on a set of principles and ideas." Senator John McCain has sanctioned creedalism by saying, "We have a nation of many races, many religious faiths, many points of origin, but our shared faith is the belief in liberty, and we believe this will prove stronger, more enduring, and better than any nation ordered to exalt the few at the expense of the many, or made from a common race or culture, or to preserve traditions that have no greater attribute than longevity." Modern U.S. presidents have endorsed this view of America. In his first inaugural address, George W. Bush proclaimed, "America has never been united by blood or birth or soil. We are bound by ideals that move us beyond our backgrounds, lift us above our interests, and teach us what it means to be citizens." Similarly, Barack Obama, at a press conference in Turkey, said, "One of the great strengths of the United States is that we have a very large Christian population. But we do not consider ourselves a Christian nation, or a Jewish nation, or a Muslim nation. We consider ourselves a nation of citizens who are bound together by ideals and a set of values." Creedalism has been ingrained in the contemporary American psyche. It has been proclaimed by Democrats and Republicans. It has been taught in schools and upheld in courts of law. It remains a truism virtually beyond dispute in the public forum and serves as the basis of political correctness. Who can argue that America is not unique? That aside from the remnants of the Indian tribes, the United States has no autochthonous population? That all of the 308.7 million people who inhabit our nation are either themselves immigrants or descendants of more or less recent immigrants? America remains linguistically and ethnically the most diverse country on earth. And since Americans are from different countries, they must be united by something. And that something has to be their basic beliefs as expressed by the founding fathers and upheld by U.S. jurisprudence. What else can it be? The belief that the American people are united by scraps of paper may be a comforting conceit for modern multiculturalists, but it has no basis in reality. Sure, the United States is the land of immigrants, but all nationalities, races, and religions have not been blended into a mythical melting pot and recast into something that is genuinely American. Americans throughout history have not been a vague commodity, an unidentifiable mass, or a nebulous conglomerate. Until the turn of the 21st century, they were a clearly discernible people, recognizable when traveling abroad by their speech, mannerisms, and appearance, not by their shared belief in a free marketplace or a federal union of independent states. Americans could be characterized as cartoon figures in German newspapers and lampooned as stock characters in French films. Few, even inhabitants of Outer Mongolia, had trouble spotting a Yank from a Yaki. There was reason for this recognizability. The colonists who came to its shores from the founding of Jamestown in 1607 to the outbreak of the Revolutionary War were, by and large, of English and Scottish stock, augmented by a sizable number of settlers from Holland, Sweden, Germany, and Ireland. They were predominantly Protestant and gave a Protestant direction to American life from the beginning. America, for them, was the new Zion in the wilderness, where they would establish a holy community, bound together by faith, covenant, and blood. This vision gave rise to the country's sense of a great calling, a providential plan, a manifest destiny. At the time of the American Revolution, the British Protestant element constituted at least 76% of the 3 million whites. In addition, the land was occupied by 750,000 blacks who had been imported as slaves from Africa. Hailing the lack of diversity in the colonies, John Jay wrote in The Federalist, "Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs." The great influx came in the next century. The population of America soared in the years from 1840 to 1920, as over 35 million immigrants washed upon our shores in three great waves. By the time the Great Migrations came to an end, the British Protestant element had been reduced to less than half the population, and America became linguistically and ethnically the most diverse country in the world. Racially, however, it was a different story, since the new arrivals were white Europeans. The cause of the Great Migrations was a profound upheaval in the social and economic order of the Old World. The revolution in industry and agriculture that began in the 18th century had shattered the time-worn structures of towns and villages throughout Europe, giving rise to large numbers of displaced peasants, merchants, and artisans who could not eke out an existence by performing the work that had provided a measure of security for their ancestors. The sharp rise in population, coupled with the radical transformation in technology, created a buildup of economic and social pressure that could only be alleviated by emigration. And emigration, of course, meant setting sail for the New World. By the 1840s, the annual rate of immigrants was in the hundreds of thousands. In each year in the decade between 1847 and 1857, more than 200,000 Europeans arrived in America, the high point being 1854 with the arrival of 400,000. The newcomers were predominantly from Britain, southwest Germany, and after the Great Potato Famine of 1846, Ireland. This inundation represented the first wave. The second wave, bridging the years from the conclusion of the Civil War in 1865 to the start of the new century, brought millions more from Britain, Germany, and Ireland, along with Scandinavians and Eastern Europeans. In 15 of these 35 years, the annual influx exceeded 400,000, with some 800,000 arriving in 1882 alone. But even these figures could not prepare the new land for the third and final wave which swept our shores from 1900 to the outbreak of World War I in 1915. In three of these 15 years, the figure reached 1 million. In 1907, it topped 1.25 million. This wave carried immigrants from Italy, Poland, Austria, Russia, Greece, and the Balkans. The epic story of the Great Migrations came to an end with the legislative restrictions of the 1920s. By this time, 35 million Europeans, not Asians, Africans, or Hispanics, had arrived to start a new life in the new republic. 4.5 million from Ireland, 4 million from Great Britain, 6 million from Central Europe, 2 million from the Scandinavian countries, 5 million from Italy, 8 million from Eastern Europe, and 3 million from the Balkans. The people were diverse ethnically, but not religiously, culturally, or even linguistically. They shared a common Western heritage. 95% were Protestants, Catholics, or Jews, 63% Protestant, 23% Catholic, and 4% Jews, and all, in time, became obliged for the purposes of education and employment to speak English. America is a product of the English language, European culture, and Western religion. At the turn of the 20th century, proponents of the melting pot looked forward to a genuine blending of cultures for the creation of the new American culture, a culture that was no more English than German or Italian, but something transcendent and all-embracing, a culture with its own unique language, a race of people who were white chocolate with slightly slanted eyes. To a certain degree, this happened. American cuisine came to include antipasto and spaghetti, frankfurters and sauerkraut, filet mignon and French fried potatoes, borscht and pickled herring, on a perfect equality with fried chicken, ham and eggs, and pork and beans. But the model for assimilation was never an ambiguous entity, a bronze composite of mixed races who spoke a universal language and proclaimed a new religion of international brotherhood. The model remained as fixed as Plymouth Rock. Will Herberg points this out as follows in Protestant Catholic Jew.
It would be a mistake to infer that the American's image of himself, and that means the ethnic group's image of himself as he becomes an American, is a composite or synthesis of the ethnic elements that have gone into the making of an American. It is nothing of the kind. The American's image of himself is still the Anglo-American ideal it was at the beginning of our national existence.
To be an American meant not only to be a European, but an Anglo-Saxon. America's self-image had been defined by the Mayflower, John Smith, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Davy Crockett, the Alamo, and Abraham Lincoln. And this image remained etched in granite whether the American in question was a direct descendant of the Pilgrims or the grandson of an immigrant from the steppes of the Ural Mountains. Various ethnic groups tried to set forth various individuals with a kind of putative colonial past, Salem Poor, Pulaski, and Steuben. But these characters remained fringe figures in the story of America. The only exceptions were the descendants of African slaves who developed their own uniquely American culture and, although never racially assimilated, became accepted as adopted members of the American family. The process of assimilation in the new land took place not in a melting pot, but a transmuting pot, in which all the elements of the various ethnic groups became transformed to an idealized Anglo-Saxon model, a model that came to apply even to African Americans, as evidenced by the evolution of such stereotypical characters as Uncle Remus, Amos and Andy, and Sanford and Son. Bonded by blood, history, and heritage, Americans were never united by a political ideology, not even by the concept of democracy.
Democracy wastes, exhausts, and murders itself, John Adams wrote in a letter to John Taylor in 1814.
Even Thomas Jefferson, the most democratic of the founding fathers, possessed doubts about this system of government.
A democracy, he wrote to Isaac Tiffany in 1816, is the only pure republic, but impracticable beyond the limits of a town.
James Madison, the author of the Constitution, was considerably more guarded in his opinion of this system of government. In The Federalist No. 10, he maintained,
"Democracies have been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in the death."
Alexander Hamilton, the most undemocratic of the founding fathers, wrote, The ancient democracies, in which the people themselves deliberated, never possessed one feature of good government. Their very nature was tyranny. Recognizing that the United States was an organic entity, a unique blend of Western Europeans with an Anglo-American model, legislation was enacted to safeguard the racial and ethnic composition of the country as it existed at the turn of the 20th century. Such laws culminated in the Immigration Act of 1924, which limited immigration by a quota system. The number of newcomers was now limited to 2% of each nationality who lived in the country not in 1924, but in 1890. The reliance of this legislation on the ethnic composition of America before the turn of the century guaranteed that the majority of new arrivals in the future would be from Northern Europe. It is hard to conceive of an act of Congress that could be more culturally biased, and yet it received nearly unchallenged bipartisan support. The New York Times editorialized, "The country has a right to say who shall and who shall not come in. The basis of restriction must be chosen with a view not to the interests of any group or groups in this country, but rather with a view to the country's best interests as a whole." The quota system held firm until 1965, when it was decried as racist and intolerable by Teddy Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. America was a nation. But what is a nation? Nation comes from the Latin word nascere, meaning to be born. Over 100 years ago, the French historian Ernest Renan defined the nation as follows.
A nation is a living soul, a spiritual principle. Two things, which in truth are but one, constitute this soul, this spiritual principle. One is in the past, the other in the present. One is the common possession of a rich heritage of memories. The other is the actual consent, the desire to live together, the will to preserve worthily the undivided inheritance which has been handed down. The nation, like the individual, is the outcome of a long past of efforts and sacrifices and devotions. To have common glories in the past, a common will in the present, to have done great things together, to will to do the like again, such are the essential conditions for the making of a people.
America was a nation because of its lack of diversity. Its organic nature stemmed from its very tribalism, the fact that the people who inhabited the country shared a common heritage, a common history, and a common faith. As a nation, it was personified by Uncle Sam, a character derived from Samuel Wilson, a meatpacker from Troy, New York, who supplied rations for American soldiers during the War of 1812. Gradually, however, this figure came to resemble Andrew Jackson, the rough-and-tumble president who won the Battle of New Orleans, abolished the nation's central bank, and nearly clubbed to death a would-be assassin with his cane. But even fictitious characters, no less than nations, can be killed. The demise of the United States emerged from a cabal of British aristocrats who sought to establish a global government. Their motive was not idealistic. It did not stem from a dream of universal brotherhood, but rather from their desire to lay hold of the world's riches. Riches do not come from paper currency, but natural resources: gold, oil, natural gas, silver, copper, iron ore, uranium, coal, cobalt, and bauxite. The scramble for these resources causes the breakdown of borders, the uprooting of native populations, and the onset of war. Since no one possessed greater wealth than Uncle Sam, he had to be killed. The killing was slow and painful. It began with the foundation of the Federal Reserve, which allowed the cabal to take control of the American economy. It proceeded with the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations, which allowed the plotters to gain control of the U.S. State Department. and it ended with the establishment of international agencies, the United Nations, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, the institution of free trade agreements and organizations such as NAFTA and the WTO, the creation of the CIA and the onset of covert activities, and radical legislation such as the Hart-Celler Act of 1965 that opened the gates of the United States to the Third World. Uncle Sam is gone, visible only on Turner Classic Movies and reruns of Ozzie and Harriet. In his wake, the country has transformed into a place unrecognizable, a place plagued by drugs, poverty, pornography, and violence. Schools have become war zones and racial conflict commonplace. 40% of the present-day inhabitants of the United States do not have a Northern European heritage. There is no blood that binds them. 50% of Americans never darken the doorway of a church. 1 in 5 has no religious affiliation, and the country is now inhabited by more Muslims than Jews. There is no faith that unites them. Modern Americans remain almost completely oblivious of their history, with the vast majority, 84%, unable to identify the author of the Constitution. There is no history that grounds them. 70% believe that the strength of America lies in its diversity, and 90% remain unaware that a quota system ever existed. The country is not unified by language, let alone morality and religion.
One half of America, as Pat Buchanan points out, sees the other as a basket of deplorables, racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic bigots.
American unity and sense of patriotism has given way to a country rift with riots in which one half of the populace views the other half as hateful and repellent. And the land of opportunity has given way to a country in which 46% say they are underemployed and 49% remain on government assistance to make ends meet. What happened to America? The story starts with Cecil Rhodes and South Africa. Part 1. Out of Africa.
When we get piled upon one another in large cities, as in Europe, we shall become as corrupt as Europe.
Thomas Jefferson.
The real menace of our republic is the invisible government which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy legs over our cities, states, and nation.
Mayor, 1918 to 1925, John F. Hyland of New York. President Franklin Roosevelt said this on November 21, 1933.
The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centers has owned the government since the days of Andrew Jackson.
1. The Vision of a Freemason.
Take up the white man's burden. Send forth the best ye breed. Go bind your sons to exile, to serve your captive's need. To wait in heavy harness, on fluttered folk and wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half-devil and half-child.
Rudyard Kipling, White Man's Burden, 1899. The demise of Uncle Sam began with a brainstorm that struck Cecil John Rhodes on June 2, 1877, the day he became a lifetime member of the Oxford University Apollo Chapter of the Masonic Order. Rhodes immediately put the revelation to paper in a document that he called his Confession of Faith.
The idea, gleaming and dancing before one's eyes like a will-o'-the-wisp, at last frames itself into a plan. Why should we not form a secret society with but one object, the furtherance of the British Empire, and the bringing of the whole uncivilized world under British rule for the recovery of the United States, for the making the Anglo-Saxon race but one empire.
Surely, he believed, if a group of wealthy Englishmen could spread the ideal of a universal brotherhood under the Gnostic religion of Freemasonry to every civilized country, a similar group, by breeding and blood, could bring about the union of mankind under British rule. The revelation that Rhodes received as a student at Oxford that spring day would give rise to the Anglo-American establishment and the mad scramble for Africa. It would inaugurate global warfare, the rise of communism, Keynesian economics, and free trade agreements. It would bring about the formation of the Pilgrim Societies, the Council on Foreign Relations, the United Nations, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Trilateral Commission. It would produce the plague of heroin addiction, the creation of the military-industrial complex, the globalization of poverty, and the demise of nationalism. And it would result in unprecedented mass migrations, widespread coup d'état, the onset of covert operations such as Operation Gladio, Operation Mockingbird, and Operation Condor, and the emergence of radical Islam and international terrorism. At 6'3" and 200 pounds, Rhodes was an imposing figure on the campus of Oxford University. He had a leonine head, light blue eyes, wavy brown hair, a carefully groomed mustache, and a ruddy complexion. The forcefulness of Rhodes's appearance was offset only by his tinny voice. Still and all, he possessed so much charisma that one contemporary claimed that belief in Rhodes was a substitute for religion. At the age of 24, Rhodes already had developed habits that would lead to his early demise. He was a chain smoker with a preference for nicotine-rich Turkish tobacco and a prodigious consumer of alcohol. Day in and day out, he drank huge quantities of wine, whiskey, beer, champagne, and Russian kümmel liqueur. The Masonic Roots. Rhodes's dream of a world ruled by a small cadre of Englishmen was rooted in Freemasonry, which had been created in 1716. When a group of British nobles gathered at the Goose and Gridiron Alehouse to establish the Grand Lodge of London. The nobles, including Anthony Sayre, John Theophilus Desaguliers, and George Payne, were imbued with the thought of Sir Isaac Newton, who had insisted the doctrine of the Trinity was a massive fraud that had perverted the legacy of primitive Christianity. Newton further maintained that the worship of Christ in place of God, the first cause and grand architect of the universe, was idolatrous. Like Newton, the men at the alehouse shared a fascination with the geometry of Solomon's temple, as described in the Book of 1 Kings, believing, like Newton, that the temple's harmonious components, the golden sections, the conic sections, and the spirals of orthographic projection, belied an ancient history which contained the secrets of the true God of the universe, a being of infinite light, whose existence could be uncovered by proper use of abstract mathematics and Newtonian physics. The fact that this shared belief smacked of Gnosticism, an ancient heresy that had been condemned by the fathers of Western Christianity, proved to be of little concern to the forgers of modern Freemasonry. Gnosticism. Within the Gnostic Gospels, including the Gospel of Truth and the secret teaching of John, Christ was sent by the Monad, the unknown God of Acts, chapter 17, verse 23, to inform man of his true nature as a spiritual being, and to enable the soul to escape from Yaldabaoth, or the Demiurge, the malevolent God of the Old Testament, by a series of secret passwords, and to return to the realms of true light. Like the Gnostics, the founders of Freemasonry saw themselves as emissaries of the highest God, a being of immeasurable light. Knowledge of the spark of the monad that is implanted in every human being, they came to believe, can only be obtained by members of Freemasonry through a series of gradual steps, or degrees, until they are worthy of entering the Arcanum Arcanorum, the fraternity within the fraternity, and to receive
the truth which it calls light. Upon receiving this truth, Freemasons came to realize that the Prince of Darkness made Adam, whose soul was of the divine light, so that he belonged to both empires, that of light and that of darkness.
Those who remain in the lesser degrees remained unaware that he who bears the light, that is, the divine being whom they professed to seek, is in fact Lucifer, the son of morning. Manly P. Hall, the leading exponent of Freemasonry, maintained that the seething energies of Lucifer are in the hands of every Freemason who has learned the true mystery of his craft. On a supernatural level, it remains remarkable that Rhodes received his vision of a new world order on the very day he underwent the initiation rite of Freemasonry, in which he was pledged to serve as a light-bearer. It remains equally remarkable that every member of his secret society and its American counterparts would also belong to Masonic lodges. The New Catholic Faith. The founders of Freemasonry, who gathered at the Goose and Gridiron Ale House, wanted their society to be open to men of various professions, provided they were approved by the leaders of the lodge and submitted to a secret rite of initiation.
The religion of Freemasonry, Albert G. Mackey wrote in his Encyclopedia of Masonry, is not sectarian. It admits men of every creed with its hospitable bosom, rejecting none and approving none for his particular faith. It is not Judaism. It is not Christianity. It does not meddle with sectarian creeds or doctrines, but teaches fundamental truth. At its altar, men of all religions may kneel. To its creed, disciples of every faith may subscribe.
The Masonic religion quickly spread to South Africa, India, Ireland, Germany, the Netherlands, Russia, Spain, and France, where it helped to spark the French Revolution. In the United States, the list of Freemasons came to include George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, Ethan Allen, Patrick Henry, Paul Revere, John Brown, John Paul Jones, John Hancock, John Marshall, Thomas Paine, William Randolph, and Roger Sherman. The federalism that constituted the core of the U.S. Constitution was identical to the federalism laid out in the Freemasonry Constitution of 1723. By the time Rhodes received the brainstorm, Masonic lodges had sprouted up in China, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South America. Freemasonry espoused a religion that could be embraced by Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Zoroastrians, and Buddhists, a religion that served to unite all of mankind in one system of belief. The Constitution of 1723 stated,
"No private piques or quarrels must be brought within the door of the lodge. Far less any quarrels about religion or nations or state policy, we being only as Masons of the Catholic religion above mentioned. We are also of all nations, tongues, kindreds, and languages."
But this one world religion, Rhodes believed, could only be established on the basis of global political and economic unification. He wrote in his confession,
"I see the wealth and power Masons possess, the influence they hold, and I think over their ceremonies, and I wonder that a large body of men can devote themselves to what at times appear the most ridiculous and absurd rites without an object and without an end."
An achievable goal. The religious, political, and economic unification of the world, Rhodes realized by his vision, was an achievable goal. The process, in fact, had already begun. Almost overnight, England had been industrialized by a revolution that gave birth to spinning machines and high-pressure steam engines that could be used not only in mining and manufacturing, but also to power locomotives and cargo ships. huge foundries, munitions plants, canneries, and silk mills had sprouted up in cities throughout England, thanks to the newborn concept of financial capitalism. Raw material was being shipped to English plants and factories from the four corners of the globe. Goods were being created in such quantity that the surplus could be shipped out to ports throughout the world, and the English banking system came to the fore as the leading force in international affairs and economics. The population of England soared from 8.3 million in 1801 to 30.1 million at the time of Rhodes. Wealth became confined to those who controlled the means of production and finance. The industrial merchant became replaced by the industrial millionaire. Marx and Engels, in their Communist Manifesto, explained,
"All old established national industries have been destroyed, or are daily being destroyed. They are dislodged by new industries, whose introduction becomes a life and death question for all civilized nations, by industries that no longer work up indigenous raw material, but raw material drawn from the remotest zones. Industries whose products are consumed not only at home, but in every quarter of the globe. In place of the old wants, satisfied by the production of the country, we find new wants requiring for their satisfaction the products of distant lands and climes. In place of the old local and national seclusion and self-sufficiency, we have intercourse in every direction, universal interdependence of nations."
The thought of Cecil Rhodes was inexorably bound to these changes in material productivity. The master race. The superiority of the British race was evident to Rhodes by the fact that the tiny island of England already ruled an empire that consisted of over 25% of the world's population and land mass. The empire included India, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Gibraltar, the West Indies, and several colonies in Africa. The inhabitants of these colonies, Rhodes believed, were beings who had not fully evolved from their ape-like ancestors and, therefore, were totally incapable of self-rule.
"The native is to be treated as a child and denied the franchise. We must adopt a system of despotism in our relations with the barbarians of South Africa."
Casting aside any attempt at eloquence, Rhodes added,
"I prefer land to niggers."
This racial awareness provided the impetus to Rhodes's confession.
"I contend that we are the finest race in the world, and that the more of the world we inhabit, the better it is for the human race," Rhodes wrote. "Just fancy those parts that are at present inhabited by the most despicable specimens of human beings. What an alteration there would be if they were brought under Anglo-Saxon influence. Look again at the extra employment a new country added to our dominions gives. I contend that every acre added to our territory means, in the future, birth to some more of the English race who otherwise would not be brought into existence. Added to this, the absorption of the greater portion of the world under our rule simply means the end of all wars. Having these ideas, what scheme could we think of to forward this object?"
And he, Cecil John Rhodes, the son of a country vicar in England, had been singled by divine providence and the process of natural selection to establish British rule over all creation, and to bring an end, at long last, to the sad human spectacle of war and ruin. 2. The African Hellhole.
Of all the targets of European empire builders, Africa was nearest, and Black Africa among the least advanced. Yet save for its far south, it was the last to be grabbed. Its coast had been known to Europeans for centuries and was dotted with their trading posts.
But until around 1860, the interior was protected. Fevers killed off intruding white men, roads were few, and cataracts blocked access by river. Then, setting off from their enclaves along the shores, European explorers began to walk old Arab trade routes. They searched for the truth of ancient stories about the Dark Continent and the sources of its mighty rivers. By 1862, they had reached the source of the Nile. A little later, they traced the route of the Niger. They confirmed the reality of Africa's fabled riches: ivory, gold, diamonds, emeralds, copper. Entrepreneurs also saw that instead of buying crops like cotton or palm oil from its villagers, they could set up plantations and use cheap local labor to work them. Africa was becoming too valuable to be left to the Africans.
The Scramble for Africa, The Economist, Millennium Issue. Providence, in 1873, had brought Rhodes, at the age of 16, to the mining settlement of Kimberley. He had arrived in Africa to work on his elder brother Herbert's cotton farm in Natal. After 2 years of drought and crop failure, Cecil headed off for fame and fortune at the newly discovered diamond fields 500 miles away on the Vaal River. For months, Rhodes had eked out a meager existence by working in a pit with hundreds of other prospectors. The pit would become the largest hole ever dug on the surface of the earth, a crater measuring 42 acres across and 3,583 feet deep that had been dug by 5,000 miners with picks and shovels. When the miners unearthed chunks of crystalline carbon, they sold the rocks to the dozens of Jewish merchants, including Alfred Beit, who had descended on the settlement. These merchants, in turn, cut and polished the stones into luminescent diamonds. The mining settlement consisted of thousands of canvas tents and ironclad shacks, along with 40 bars and brothels. Typhus was prevalent. The temperature averaged 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, and the air was perpetually thick with clouds of flies. Visiting Kimberley in 1887, Anthony Trollope wrote,
"If there be a place on God's earth in which a man can thoroughly make or mar himself within that space of time, it is the town of Kimberley. I know no spot more odious in every way to a man who has learned to love the ordinary modes of English life. It is foul with dust and flies. It reeks with bad brandy. It is fed upon potted meats. It has not a tree near it. It is inhabited in part by tribes of South African niggers, who have lost all the picturesqueness of niggerdom in working for the white man's wages. The white man himself is insolent, ill-dressed, and ugly. The weather is very hot, and from morning till night there is no occupation other than that of looking for diamonds and the works attending it. Diamond grubbers want food and brandy, and lawyers and policemen. They want clothes also, and a few horses, and some kind of education is necessary for their children. But diamond searching is the occupation of the place, and if a man be sharp and clever and able to guard what he gets, he will make a fortune there in 2 years more readily, perhaps, than elsewhere."
Adding to the hellish conditions, Trollope noted, the settlement was subjected to torrential downpours that transformed the deep pit into a massive yellow quagmire. In order to augment his income, Rhodes teamed up with Charles Rudd, another fortune seeker, to import an ice machine from England in order to manufacture ice cream for the sun-scorched miners. The ice cream business became such a success that Rhodes and Rudd were able to buy old agricultural steam engines, which they converted into water pumps to drain the mines when they became flooded with rainwater. By 1876, when Rhodes returned to Oxford to continue his studies and to become a Freemason, he already had become a very wealthy man. Setting the stage. In those days, Oxford remained under the spell of John Ruskin, the celebrated Don, who, in his inaugural lecture of February 8, 1870, had called upon the university community to take up the cause of British imperialism.
"There is a destiny now possible to us, the highest ever set before a nation to be accepted or refused," Ruskin said. "We are still a race mingled with of the best northern blood. We have a firmness to govern and the grace to obey. We are rich in an inheritance of honor, bequeathed to us through 1,000 years of noble history. Britain must found more and more colonies as fast and as far as she is able, formed by her most energetic and worthiest men, seizing every fruitful waste ground she can set her foot on, and there teaching her colonists that their chief virtue is fidelity to their country, and that their first aim is to advance the power of England."
Such colonization, Ruskin insisted, would result in the institution of global socialism. He said,
"The first duty of a state is to see that every child born therein shall be well housed, clothed, fed, and educated, till it attain years of discretion. But in order to the effecting of this, the government must have an authority over the people of which we now do not so much as dream."
Such stirring words had set the stage at Oxford for the appearance of Cecil Rhodes, who embraced this teaching. The first step toward a new world order, Rhodes believed in accordance with his brainstorm, was the conquest of Africa with its vast reserves of diamonds, gold, iron ore, coal, and timber.
"Africa is still lying ready for us. It is our duty to take it," he wrote in his confession. "It is our duty to seize every opportunity of acquiring more territory, and we should keep this one idea steadily before our eyes. That more territory simply means more of the Anglo-Saxon race, more of the best, the most human, most honorable race the world possesses."
Throughout his life, Rhodes's belief in the necessity of the British conquest of Africa remained unswerving. 15 years after penning his confession, he confided the following to William H. Stead, one of his most ardent disciples.
"If there is a God, it is clear that he would like me to do what he is doing himself, and he is manifestly fashioning the English-speaking race as the chosen instrument by which he will bring in a state of society based upon justice, liberty, and peace. He would like me to paint as much of the map of Africa British red as possible, and to do what I can elsewhere to promote the unity and extend the influence of the English-speaking race."
The second step was the restoration of America to the imperial fold of Great Britain. Rhodes wrote,
"I once heard it argued by a fellow in my own college, I am sorry to own it by an Englishman, that it was good thing for us that we have lost the United States. There are some subjects on which there can be no arguments, and to an Englishman this is one of them. But even from an American's point of view, just picture what they have lost. Look at their government. Are not the frauds that yearly come before the public view a disgrace to any country, and especially theirs, which is the finest in the world? Would they have occurred, had they remained under English rule, great as they have become, how infinitely greater they would have been with the softening and elevating influences of English rule. Think of those countless number of Englishmen that during the last 100 years would have crossed the Atlantic and settled and populated the United States. Would they have not made without any prejudice a finer country of it than the low-class Irish and German emigrants? All this we have lost, and that country loses owing to whom? Owing to 2 or 3 ignorant, pig-headed statesmen of the last century. At their door lies the blame. Do you ever feel mad? Do you ever feel murderous? I think I do,
with those men.
When Rhodes penned these words, America was only beginning to acquire significant economic status, and its wealth remained confined to families like the Astors, the Vanderbilts, the Morgans, and the Rockefellers, all of whom had deep roots in Britain and strong ties to the House of Rothschild, which had funded their business ventures. Seeing a ghost. Before returning to South Africa at the close of the summer semester, Rhodes suffered what has been described as a heart attack and nervous breakdown. His friends found him in his room, blue with fright, his door barricaded by a chest of drawers, while insisting that he had seen a ghost. This experience served to convince Rhodes that his life would be short, and that little time remained to make his dream of a new world order a reality. And so, to his confession, Rhodes added these words.
The society should inspire and even own portions of the press, for the press rules the mind of the people. The society should always be searching for members who might, by their position in the world, by their energies or character, forward the object, but the ballot and test for admittance should be severe. Once make it common and it fails. Take a man of great wealth who is bereft of his children, perhaps having his mind soured by some bitter disappointment, who shuts himself up, separate from his neighbors, and makes up his mind to a miserable existence. To such men as these, the society should go gradually disclose the greatness of their scheme and entreat him to throw in his life and property with them for this object. I think that there are thousands now existing who would eagerly grasp at the opportunity. Such are the heads of my scheme. For fear that death might cut me off before the time for attempting its development, I leave all my worldly goods in trust to S. G. Shippard and the Secretary for the Colonies at the time of my death to try to form such a society with such an object.
Sidney Godolphin Shippard, a fellow adventurer from South Africa, had joined Rhodes at Oxford. He would become the first administrator of the British Protectorate of Bechuanaland, now known as Botswana. Gathering guests. In September 1877, Rhodes returned to Kimberley, and his very small two-roomed corrugated iron house with a wooden floor, iron walls, and roof. To this humble dwelling, he invited his closest friends and confidants for a dinner meeting. The guests included Joseph Orpen, who would become an influential administrator for the British Crown in South Africa, Henry Caesar Hawkins, son of the resident magistrate of the Umkomas Valley, Alfred Beit, a German Jew, who dealt in diamonds, Leander Starr Johnson, a youthful physician, Charles Rudd, Shippard, and Louis Mitchell, a prominent South African banker, who recorded the words of Rhodes to the gathering as follows.
Gentlemen, I have asked you to dine because I want to tell you what I want to do for the remainder of my life. I think that if a man, when he is young, determines to devote his life to one worthy object, and persists in that, he can do a great deal during his life, even if it is to be a short one, as I know my life will be. The object to which I intend to devote my life is the defense and the extension of the British Empire. The British Empire stands for the protection of all the inhabitants of a country in life, liberty, fair play, and happiness, and is the greatest platform the world has ever seen for these purposes. It is mainly the extension of the empire northwards that we have to watch and work for in South Africa.
The men in attendance were so moved by these remarks that they agreed to join with Rhodes in devoting their lives and wealth to the extension of British rule over all creation. Their commitment was to be without personal reservation. For this reason, Rhodes urged his band of brothers to avoid all emotional entanglements, including marriage.
"I hate people getting married," he said, "because they simply become machines and have no ideas beyond their respective spouses and offspring."
The new initiates to the Kimberley Club took this advice to heart, thereby granting a hint of monasticism to their society, which would evolve into a hotbed of homosexuals and pederasts. 3. Meeting Rothschild.
I care not what puppet is placed on the throne of